the session that Dr. David Pelkovitz is giving, and I've heard him speak a few times, and every time walk away with some story that just puts everything in perspective, how to be a parent and what it's like to be a parent, how it feels to be a parent. So I'm sure you'll enjoy it. I'm not going to take any more of his time. Please give your attention to Dr. Pelkovitz.
Thank you so much, Roma. Hello.
Hi.
Okay. So it's interesting. There's the text and the subtext. What I was asked to talk about now was self-concept, but then I got an email with a little bit more of a specific request for an emphasis on how do we instill in our kid a self-concept that's not overinflated or underinflated. You know, the challenge of this generation, I think, is we're great. I was talking in the last session about love and limits. Kids need love, they need limits, they need the balance of the two. This generation, I think, is terrific love specialists. We're great at being there for our kids. We're great really putting our kids front and center on our mattering map. That's not the issue. The issue is really how do we face our children's frustrations, and how do we handle it when they are not strong in certain areas? That's how do we do that? How do we find that balance? It's interesting. It's a uniquely American phenomenon. There's some fascinating research that's come out in the last number of years that shows that, in fact, if you ask the average Japanese parent how well her kid, his or her kid, does in math, the average Japanese parent says they estimate that their kids are average or slightly below average in math. Ask the average American parent how well their kid does in math, they say, oh, my kid is way above average in math. The reality is that the Japanese kids are head and shoulders above our kids in math as a whole, and our kids are actually fairly low relative to the kids of the rest of the world, and there's no correlation at all between the level of confidence that we instill in our kids and the reality, and that could be a little dangerous. It could be a little dangerous because our kids won't accomplish all they can if, in fact, we don't find the right window of how to push and how not to push. So that's interestingly, by the way, similar studies show that the average American thinks that they're very above average drivers. And having just driven here from Long Island, especially once you get onto 4 West, there's some very interesting driving behavior. So whoever, all the below average people seem to, you know, hit around here. By the way, I had to come via the Cross Bronx. That's where you really see some scary stuff. And on, you see those kind of examples. When in fact the research shows that you want to balance. You want to balance. You always want your kid to believe in themselves, but you don't want them believing in themselves when in fact it's based on false impressions, when in fact it's not backed up with real stuff. Now, I'm going to give you some examples of that, and maybe we can get some of the discussion going. Interesting. We all know there's a famous, very famous Jewish insight on this, talking about who has Hasidic knowledge? I can never get it right. The position of Rebbe. Oh, that's good. That I could say. That I could say. Can never pronounce his name. That's my, one day I'll have to get some remedial lessons on pronouncing that. So anyway, he has this famous, insight into, the Bali Musar would tell us that, you know, there's this tension in Judaism between, on the one hand, it says, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. We should raise our children in a way that they think the world was created for me. And we also know there's another stream throughout Judaism of Anochi Afar Va'efer, which is what Avram said about himself, I'm but dust and ashes. And interestingly, by the way, B'shvili Nivra Ha'olam, if you look at the context it's said in, it's not said in the context of entitlement. It's said, on the contrary, in the context of responsibility. It's talking about the awesome responsibility of a person who is testifying as a witness in a capital trial. And if you're testifying as a witness in any trial, you have to understand your unique responsibility. So the B'shvili Nivra Ha'olam means that in terms of understanding that we have a unique responsibility to others. It's not an entitlement. But what he says, I won't repeat his name again, but I'll call on you to say whenever I need it. Thank you. What he says is that at all times we should have in one pocket a piece of paper saying B'shvili Nivra Ha'olam, and in the other pocket a piece of paper saying Anochi Afar Ve'efer. But he says the wisdom, and this is the wisdom in raising our children, is how to know which pocket to dip into and when. He says all too often, if we don't get shlishi in shul, or we don't get a certain kibbutz, or people don't treat us well, we go into the B'shvili Nivra Ha'olam pocket, and we should maybe be thinking with a little bit more modesty. And when do we do the Nochi Afar Ve'efer? If somebody comes to us and says, hey, could you get involved in this community project, or the school needs help with this? You say, but me? I mean, I'm a Nochi Afar Ve'efer. He says, we have to know. He says, the wisdom, and I think if I could paraphrase, the wisdom of raising children in terms of this issue of self-concept is how do we raise them to know when to dip into which pocket? Because as we know, self-concept is everything. And I'm going to talk to you about it from different different standpoints. I'm going to do it through the prism of three studies that I'll start with. Study number one is a study that I find unbelievable. And I once replicated this study. It was a fascinating thing to see. It's they take kids and they put them in a room with their mothers. By the way, the research is always with the mothers. Only I try to do research on fathers also. It's not as mother blaming as one would think. It's just that it's almost impossible to get fathers to cooperate with research. Okay, I've struggled many times, and I'm almost at the point of giving up. But anyway, so you get a mother and their daughter or son in a room, and you give them a puzzle to do. That's just slightly above the ability of the child. Slightly above the ability of the child. The mother is told, you can't really help. You can encourage. You could be there, but you can't help. And there's two outcomes that you see. One outcome is kids who were energized by the challenge. Totally energized. They just keep trying and keep trying. And they almost like, you can't get them to give up. Those are the kids who are motivated, clearly have a positive self-concept and believe in themselves. Then there are other kids who give up almost immediately. Okay, what differentiates child one from child two? And it turns out that what differentiates one child from another is that the mothers are the highly motivated children. They teach the children how to believe in themselves. Here's just some examples from the study. They constantly reassure the child. They say, you could do it. I know you could do it. Okay? They make suggestions. Say, maybe try it this way. Try it that way. And the child's attention is shifted away from feelings of inadequacy and back towards mastering the task. It's horrifying, though, to see the parents of the children who give up. It's usually looking, and I've experienced this, and I once did a study like this with abused children. And I still have the videos. They're very upsetting to see, because you'd have the mother look through the one-way mirror and say to me, you know, what's wrong with you, doctor? You gave my child a puzzle that he can't possibly do. He's not smart enough for this. Can you please bring in an appropriate puzzle? And constant messages that say, you can't do it, give up, don't listen to him, etc. And you see the construction of a poor self-concept and the construction of a low motivation to achieve. And that's what it's about. That's what it's about. It's about is how do we raise our children in an atmosphere that teaches them that a setback isn't something that should necessarily even frustrate them. A setback is something that should challenge them to try even harder. Unbelievable study that some of you may have heard of. It's one of my favorite studies that I've come across in the last few years. It's the neurosurgeon study. There's a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania, a medical sociologist. He wrote a book on this. And one of the things he looked at in trying to understand this phenomenon is he looked at the top 1% of neurosurgeons and the bottom 1%. Now, to become a neurosurgeon, you have to really, really be, you know, we know what it takes. First, you have to get into medical school. Then you have to get into a general surgery, training program. And then you specialize, subspecialize, you keep going and going. It's longer than a Chafetz Chaim smicha. It takes forever, okay? You know, you just keep going. You don't even finish till you're well into your third. It takes forever. So you're dealing with very bright, very skilled people, I imagine, okay? At least from what I've heard and what I've seen. Now, what's this study? He looks at the top 1%, the neurosurgeons across the country who have the fewest deaths, who have the best success rate, who are head and shoulders above their colleagues. And then he compared them to the bottom 1%. The bottom 1% were the ones who washed out of their residency programs, the ones who get fired. And it's fascinating because you know what differentiates? You know what the key differentiator is? Again, this is a self-concept issue also. It's very much tied to this. The key differentiator wasn't how many IQ points. It wasn't even manual dexterity. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with how they handled mistakes. Okay? Think about this. This has unbelievable implications for parenting. If the neurosurgeon in the top 1%, God forbid, lost the patient, he or she would be energized, not in a happy way. They would not go home till they figured out what went wrong. They would run down to the library to read every article they could find on this. They'd call colleagues all over the world who were experts in this area. What did I do wrong? I tried this, I tried that. They'd go to the animal lab, redo the surgery over and over and over again in the animal lab. They'd go to the morgue and keep going nonstop, often staying up all night, often not resting till they really had embraced what had happened as an instrument for learning, an instrument for correction, and it's what gave them the edge. Then you go into the operating room of the bottom 1%. And it's chilling to read the transcripts of that part of the study. The bottom 1% would say, oh, yeah, sure, I lost that patient. What do you expect with the terrible lighting in the operating room? And those nurses are horrible. This hospital just can't get good nurses. And it was blaming everybody around, both the hospital, the nurses, everything except taking a good hard look at what it was that you did. So take home message number one is the art of instilling in our children a realistic self-concept is to teach them not how to falsely believe in themselves, but to teach them to have realistic appraisals of themselves, but to really believe in themselves, to believe, hey, you could do it. You could try it. If you mess up, fine. That's how you learn. So that failure is not experienced as failure. It's experienced as feedback. And you're taught, and many of you know super parents who are able to do this. Super parents are able to somehow kind of, now, or maybe it's not that rare. I don't know. I mean, I'm often amazed at how many parents I see really able to do this. But that's the basic take-home message number one, is confidence based on what the child could do and based on their own personal best. So that's number one. That's number one. Number two is the subtleties, okay? This is the Clever Hans study. Some of you may remember it from Psych 101. But I find that actually, it's good to review it. And many of you probably don't know Clever Hans' story. It's a study done by Ebbinghaus, one of the classic studies of psychology, and boy, does it have implications for self-concept in children. Here's what happened. I think it was in the early part of the 1900s, word gets out about a horse somewhere in the Midwest, I think, that's a genius horse in math. A math superstar, you know, gifted horse in math. You could ask this horse any math problem whatsoever, and the horse will patiently tap out the answer flawlessly. If the answer is 122, it'll tap out 122 and stop. If the answer is 18, 19, 30, 200, it'll get the answer 100% each time. Not bad, okay? So you think, okay, this must be some, you know, weird stuff going on that has nothing to do with the charlatan trying to make money. Turns out the farmer who owned Hans was actually not so happy with this horse because he wanted to go about the business of farming. He wasn't so interested in having all the people who were coming to see this genius horse. It was ruining his business. And a psychologist named Ebbinghaus hears about this, and he says, maybe I can help you out. Maybe we can figure out what's going on here. He goes, fully intending to uncover some kind of fraud. Can't find any fraud. This is one smart horse. You ask, no matter what you ask, I don't care what it is, if the answer could be tapped out with the hoofs of a horse, Hans, flawless. Okay? Until Dr. Ebbinghaus comes up with one obvious but terrific idea. He puts a screen between him and the horse and now asks Clever Hans the very same questions. And now it becomes a special needs math horse. Gets zero every time. Cannot answer anything. Okay? Anybody know why? It's obvious why. What changed? It's not that this horse knew anything about math. Horses can't do math. We all know that. You know, even we don't know anything about horses. Horses can't do math. It's what the horse was a genius in, as many horses are, was reading the subtle nonverbal cues of its owners. The subtle nonverbal cues of whoever was asking the question. So the answer was 216. At 216, the breathing of the questioner would subtly change. An eyebrow would be suddenly raised. And the horse would say, oh, this is it, and would stop tapping. Now, that's the mushal. What's the nimshal? The nimshal is an obvious nimshal, okay? The nimshal is that when we are with our children, okay? When we are with our children, we actually constantly are giving messages like that about what we believe they could do and what we don't believe they could do. That's what's happening on a regular basis, okay? So, again, so the take-home message of the neurosurgeon study is we have to teach our children how to mess up and make mistakes in a way that they are energized by them and see it as a challenge and don't get defensive. But instead, that's what differentiates the top 1% of neurosurgeons from the bottom 1%. Think about that in your parenting. Think about that in teaching about self-concept. In the Clever Hans story, it's we need to get caught up in the subtle messages we give to our children. Rabbi Weinreb just came, and I heard this. Welcome, Dr. Weinreb. I just heard, I was reminded of a study that I heard from him, another classic study in psychology, but I once heard it from you in this context, and it's the study of Pygmalion in the classroom. So it's taking it from the horse to kids. And again, another very famous study, wonderful study, where what they did was is they told, I forget how many classrooms it was, but it's an unbelievable study. And again, I apologize if you've heard it, but it's worth reviewing because it's exactly the finding of the Ebbinghaus study brought to children instead of to horses. The horses, I don't know what you could do with so much, you know. How many of us have horses? But listen to this study. They tell some teachers, beginning of the year, let's say you have 10 fifth grade classes, and all the fifth grade classes are divided so that all the classes are just average, regular old kids. Nothing unusual. It's exactly evenly divided. But they take one teacher and they say, you hit the jackpot. You have the gift of class this year. And they give them the computer printout of this class, and the teacher now thinks that he or she struck it rich. They have the gifted class. What teacher doesn't dream of having that? You have the gifted class. In fact, they had tested all the kids beforehand very carefully, and these kids had they were every bit as average, in quotes, as any of the other kids in the other fifth grade classes. Okay, punchline is obvious. Punchline is, at the end of the year, okay, the kids who had the teacher who thought they were gifted had statistically significant higher IQs. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. On achievement test scores, they had statistically significant higher achievement test scores, and their grades were higher than at any time before or since in their school career. Okay? It's the power of expectations. But like I started at the beginning with the puzzle study, okay? I started with the puzzle study, and what I told you with the puzzle study is something very important. And that's that the key is, unlike the American mothers, we need to think more like the Japanese mothers, okay? That it needs to be in a way that we always have our kids know that we expect the world of them and that we believe in them. But it always has to be measured up against the personal best and a real belief in them without false reassurance and without falsely building up abilities that they just don't have. And the key thing is it doesn't matter. It's fine if you don't have an ability in this area. Shine in another area. That's the key of self-concept. Self-concept is the reflected appraisals of others. If we bounce back to our, because there's a beautiful thought about Yosef. Okay, we just ended Bereishis, but I can't get away from that so easily, because there's so much unbelievable child psychology there. So in the famous Medrash on the Mustyukna Shalav Evra B'Chalom, okay? Right? So here you have this adolescent boy far away from home, feeling who knows what in terms of lonely and abandoned. And he now has this seduction scene, right? So the wife of Potiphar tries to seduce him. And what stops him? It's good old Jewish guilt, right? The flashing of his father's image. But there's a beautiful, beautiful thought about this. I forget who I heard this from. But you know what he saw reflected back in the window? It wasn't his father's face. It was his father's expectations of him. It's what his father believed in him. His father, Yaakov, had a special valuing of gratitude, of hakara satov. Gratitude, right? An essentially Jewish concept to be a Yehudi is to be grateful. So what did his father, if you look carefully, his father was the first one who built miknah, you know, who built shelters for animals. Because he was even grateful to animals. At the time that Yosef went off to the disastrous events of that day, his father is sending him to check on his brothers, but to check on the cattle. Gratitude was high up on Yaakov's mattering mat. So now, Potiphar takes him in, right? How could he show a lack of gratitude by allowing himself to be seduced by Potiphar's wife? So what did he see reflected back? What he saw reflected back was his father's expectation of him. And our children will often rise to our expectations. But those expectations have to be grounded in reality, and they have to be grounded in confidence, and they have to be grounded in looking at the best. And I'm going to develop that a little bit more later. Let me go back to the key issues I was asked to focus on. And what I'm going to do is talk about three other components of self-concept in terms of motivating children in a realistic way without giving them a false sense of self, but a grounded self-concept. One is space. The research shows over and over again that giving our children space, helping them experience success and failure, not as a reward and punishment, but as feedback, is the key predictor of this variable. Okay? It's a style that conveys faith in their abilities, without taking over for the child, and somehow all the nonverbal ways that's shown. Let me tell you a very strange study, but I like this study, okay? Because again, it shows how when we try to motivate kids in too ostensible, too overt a way, it's not so great. Listen to this study. Bunch of 5-year-old kids in 2 kindergarten classes. And they decide in this brilliant design to introduce a new food to the children. So one kindergarten class, the new food is brought in. It's some drink that tastes good, but they bring it in, they set it up for the kids every day for the next 6 months. Say, okay, so there's a new drink. If you want to drink it, if you don't want it, don't drink it. Fine. They just set up like a little, the equivalent of a lemonade stand, where the kids could help themselves as they went throughout the day from that drink. No big deal. Other class, they roll it out like something out of, an ad campaign on Madison Avenue, right? They say, kids, we have the most unbelievable new drink for you. Anybody who drinks this drink once is going to get 1 star, 2 glasses, you get 2 stars. Rewards, and we're going to write letters home and really rewarding them incredibly for drinking this drink. Now, what happens? Fascinating what happens. For the first 2-3 weeks, you look at the consumption of the drink by the kids who are rewarded versus the kids who aren't, and the obvious happens. You know, the kids in the rewarded class are drinking up a storm, and other kids are barely trying it. 6 months later, there is much, much higher consumption of the drink in the non-rewarded class, and the rewarded kids won't touch this stuff in spite of the rewards. Okay? It's amazing. It's amazing. We have to figure out a way to tap into our kids' internal, natural drive for success and competence. And again, in terms of finding the balance between Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, okay, and Anochi Afar Ve'efer, part of that comes from an internal development that's this subtle bouncing off of what's on our face, what's the look on our face, like the look to that horse who is the math genius, okay? What's the look on our face in terms of what we expect of our children, like the look on that 5th grade teacher's face as he thought he was teaching the gifted kids? Or, for that matter, the internalized look on Yaakov's face as Yosef is looking into his soul to see, hey, does my father think better, you know, think that I'm better than this? So that's in terms of space. The next issue is the issue in terms of the ingredients of a positive self-concept that's not as obvious as one may think. Is obviously confidence that's built up in a realistic way. Use of praise and encouragement that conveys a belief that they could do it, but is sincere and not coming from an attempt to control the child and in a way that is specific to what they did. You've probably heard this before, but it's a major parenting kind of chachma that it's worth reviewing. And that's that. Praise that works best is specific. It spells out what you like that the child did. It's sincere, and it's not easily given. You don't give praise for something that the child didn't earn. Kids pick up on that, and they develop a parent deafness to that. So praise needs to come. I'm not saying it's wonderful when you praise your child, but find something that you really like that they're doing and build on that. Make sure to note it. Because there's nothing like the look on a child when you're making them feel competent. That's part of one of the basic building blocks of building a positive self-concept in terms of the positive components of it. But it needs to be tied to their behavior. It needs to be coming from inside. And it shouldn't be done in a glib way and in a general way. Praise the behavior. Praise it in an operationalized specific ways. And that goes along with the confidence that I was talking about in the puzzle study as well. Number 3 is clear expectations. Okay? This is an important one. I see it all too often. Clarity of expectations. You know, there's a beautiful pasuk. I think it's in Mishlei. It says, Be'ein chazon yifara'am. When there's no vision, we drift away. And if you look at the Vilna Gaon on that pasuk, what you could read into it, even though it really has a different connotation if you look at the Mefarshim on that pasuk, but there are hints in that it's all about that vision thing, okay? Kids need to know what is it that our vision is for them, but more importantly, what are their plans as they get older for themselves? Self-concept is part of that. Self-concept is part of clarity of expectations, both our school's expectation for our kids, our expectations for them, but their internal sense of expectations based on their own uniqueness and their own unique needs. You know, the Gemara tells us that the best way to motivate kids in this way is you have to find the balance between his learning or her learning ma shalibo chafetz and mi shalibo chafetz. You need the right messenger and you need the right content material. When you have both of that, then you get a kid who's motivated. But when you don't have that, you could have a problem. And then the final component, I'm going to end now with one final component where I'm going to share with you some new research that just came out of our place at YU last week. And then I'm going to end with the double story. Okay? So let's do it that way. Here's the study that came out last week. We're doing a study of predictors of satisfaction with changes in the year in Israel. So we looked at 230 seniors from various yeshivot, modern Orthodox high schools in the New York metropolitan area. And we looked at, okay, what predicts, what family factors, what relationships with teachers, what psychological factors, what predicts religious actions and religious beliefs. Right now, we only did time one. We didn't look at them after Israel, but we do have a snapshot of, okay, what is it? If your dream for your kids is that they grow up to reflect our values in Judaism, what is it that predicts it in terms of school variables and in terms, more importantly, of parenting variables? And of course, it's not surprising, obviously, that close families where there's a good bond, if your bein adam l'chavero is good, your connection with your parents is good, your connection with God is probably going to be good also. Okay, makes sense. Now, but here's the weird thing that came out. I'm sitting with a couple of my students in the basement of Belfer Hall. And, you know, a year's worth of effort comes at that moment, right? You ask the computer to do these fancy statistical multiple regression analyses to see what is the most powerful predictor of religious actions and religious beliefs. And we had about 15 variables. And it was really, we were really excited about it. And guess what comes up as number one? You know what comes up as number one? More than anything, the parent stuff is extremely important. Relationships with the teacher, extremely important. You know what number one is? Optimism. It's a positive view of the religion, predicted more than anything. And what comes out is for us to somehow teach our children that this is a religion and this is a relationship with God that needs to be positive. I'm reminded, I said this last week to a group of colleagues at YU, of a story of a boy who goes off. We have Rabbi Weinreb here. It's a good MCSY story. It's a wonderful story. A boy goes off to, a boy becomes an at-risk child. He's incredibly rebellious. Parents don't know what to do with him. They manage to hide from the NCSY people the fact that he is a problem. And he goes off to one of the NCSY summer programs. And it turns out that the strength of that program is machsheves, is teaching kids about God, teaching kids about Jewish philosophy. And the kid comes back. The parents just wanted him out of their hair for 6 weeks. The kid comes back and he's transformed. He's no longer an at-risk kid. He's no longer rebellious. And they ask him, what happened? And this is a kid who was going to an all-male, great hat yeshiva. Okay? And he comes back and here's what he says. He says, you know something? Until you sent me to this program, My conception of God was the God of the no's. Don't do this. Don't do that. Shabbos. Don't do this on Shabbos. He said to me, what God is about is the don'ts. For the first time, I go to this program, and what do I learn? I learn for the first time who God is. I learn what this religion is about. I learn about the beauty. And that's what turned him around. It's an amazing thing to see, that kind of optimism. You know, if you want to see an unbelievably brilliant article, what's the name of that journal? A-Z-U-R-E? Rav Meir Soloveitchik has a beautiful, beautiful piece on looking at the optimism of Rav Akiva and how it shaped Jewish history. Looking at his optimism, looking at how here's a man, you talk about self-concept, you know, and he ascribes it to the love of a woman, the love of his wife. And love does that. The love of a parent does it as powerfully, if not more powerfully. That because of the love of his wife, here's a man who's able to go at age 40 and start to learn knowing nothing. Knowing nothing. And his Rebbe ignored him for 10 years. Ignored him. Who was it? Was it Lozer? It was, ignored him for 10 years. And in spite of that, he kept persevering, kept that optimistic view, and it shaped Jewish history. And it goes on brilliantly. If you have it, you could, it's available for free on the web. You punch in Rav Meir Soloveitchik, Rav Akiva, it'll come up. It's unbelievably interesting story about the power of optimism in religion. So in terms of self-concept, we need to figure out a way to focus on the positive. There's a fascinating study that was published a few years back where they looked at a bunch of Chiloni Israeli kids on a test of geometric reasoning and compared them to a group of a couple of hundred comparison kids from a Haredi yeshiva high school where they never had a single class in geometry. And they do a test of geometric reasoning on these kids. Okay? And what they find is that the Haredi kids, who never had a single geometry course, do much better than the Chiloni kids. And if you look in the article, you start to see why. It's not just because learning Gemara teaches you that kind of reasoning. It's because they approached it with fun. They approached it in a positive way. When we have that milsa v'dichusa, when we have that positive, optimistic, fun approach, it loosens up our brain. And it makes an enormous difference. Let me end with a story, double story. But it'll bring out the importance of really how we cultivate a self-concept. And it goes like this. I'm stuck on last week's parsha, but I can't help it because it's such a psychological parsha and it's still in my head. So here's what happens. Rav Hirsch, brilliantly, on the brachos of Yaakov to his children, says, look at them carefully, and you'll see that they're not typical blessings. They're descriptions. They're descriptions. It's descriptions, dead-on right descriptions of the children. And he goes on to explain that that's the greatest bracha. When somebody gets us, you talk about self-concept, when somebody gets us, there is no greater bracha than when we feel our parents in particular get us and are pushing their dreams onto us. They get us and are fostering and fanning the flames of our uniqueness. That's the ultimate bracha. That's the ultimate bracha. So here's the story I want to end with along those lines, because it's really what self-concept and nurturing self-concept is all about. Goes like this. Priority One weekend, a number of years ago, weekend for families of kids at risk. They have people up on the Bima, and they have about 9 kids, if I remember correctly, all of whom had left our way of life because of alienation. And what you see is each one, like I was saying before, eluded the bumper sticker of society or the family. So one kid says, oh, the way I stopped being religious, as I was sexually abused and nobody knew about it. So I found solace with equally marginalized peers. That was a major theme that you see with these kids sometimes. Another kid said, I had an undiagnosed learning disability. Nobody knew about it. I just felt increasingly a failure. And that's what happened there. Another kid says, you know, I came from a family whose bumper sticker was chesed or bus, and I'm a little bit of a, impulsive person. It's harder for me to be empathic because of the learning disability I have. And it went on and on and on, where it became clear that somehow their uniqueness evaded either the parents or more likely the school parents and shul and community. So at that Shabbaton, Rabbi Brachman, who is the principal of Yeshiva Far Rockaway, gets up and he says the following. He says, I've been hearing about this uniqueness issue. And he said, I noticed that as fathers were benching their children Friday night here, this is a Friday night talk he gave, they were relating to their children in a totally different way, depending on that child. I never noticed this. He said, some kids, the parents were relating in one way, some kids another way. I didn't quite understand it at the time. But he said, Friday night, fan the flame of uniqueness of your child, okay? Tune into it for the rest of the week. I didn't get it. Next Shabbos, I go home. I have four kids, okay, B'liai and Harai, and I started tuning in to something that had been unconscious for my whole career as a parent. And I see that, in fact, I have a whole thing going on that I never knew I had. My oldest son is taller than me. We have a macho thing going on when I bench him as I reach up to him. My next child has a tremendous amount of chen, that daughter. So her chen comes through somehow. It shines as I bench her. The next child is really funny. She's really funny. She has a lot of other wonderful attributes as they all do. She's really, really funny. So we have this jokey thing going on. And my youngest daughter is very cuddly. And she cuddles into me in a way that captures the essence of her soul. And I started noting that. You should try this also. Those of you who have the Friday night minhag, the benching, it's a wonderful minhag. And a wonderful takana, talk about self-concept. No greater way to enhance self-concept than to get your child, the bracha of Yaakov, to his children. So I tell over this story Sunday morning to a group of mental health professionals. And one of the psychologists comes up to me, and he tells me the following story. With this, I'll end. He said his patient that morning was a 15, 16-year-old kid who was having some problems with rebelliousness, yeshiva kid. And he told him that the night before, he was very tempted to go to the next level in his rebellion. He was hanging out with some friends who were marginal, but not so terrible, and some kids who he knew peripherally call him into the pool hall on that street. And they call him in, and he's feeling all important, like, wow, here I am, I have these kids, I'm finally in, I'm finally accepted. And one of them offers him a new drug. He had only tried marijuana until then. Now he was going to the next level. And he tells his therapist that Sunday morning, as I'm reaching for the drug, involuntarily, you know what flashes through my head? An image of my father. It's the Mustyukna moment. An image of my father benching me the night before. And the look of love in his eyes. And I thought to myself, I'm better than this. I'm better than this. How could I do this? My father would never believe that I would do this. Without even thinking, I take the drug, I throw it back at the kid and I run out. And I want to tell you, Doc, he tells the therapist, I'm not going back there anymore. I can't do that to my father. That's the message. That's the message. The message is self-concept. That we look at the four ingredients of clarity and confidence and space and choice and all the other stuff. I didn't talk about all of it in joy, but what it's all about is connecting to our kids, spending the time with our children, believing in them, and fanning the flame of their uniqueness. Finding it, fanning it, accepting it, and not having them live out our dreams. Finding a way to help them live out their dreams. And that's the final message. We have time for, we have about 8 minutes for questions until we move on to the next part of the program. Any thoughts, questions? You want to talk about your neighbor's children, please, in the back. Yes.
On a practical level, let's say you have certain kids, let's say you have a
Right.
How do I get off?
Excellent question. Just repeat the question. The question is a question of, let's say you have one kid who's a natural born pitcher, another kid who's a bit of a klutz and maybe a better right fielder or catcher or something like that. Or not even a ball player altogether. And how do you do that? So there are different ways, and how do you? So first of all, I'll say the obvious, and that's that we should never treat our children equally. It's a myth to think we should treat them equally. We should treat them according to their own unique needs. Look at last week's Parsha. You see totally different descriptions of the unique temperaments of each of those children. So we should not treat them that way. The key is to find areas that they excel in, and every child has that, and fan the flames of that. And what the research shows us is to the extent that we could help them understand that they shouldn't be defining themselves through the strengths of a sibling. The sibling is a great pitcher, great, but that means that maybe, you know, that kid has great musical ability or great artistic ability or great scholastic ability or whatever it is. So the general idea is to not look at kids as needing to be equal, to find out what their self-concept comes in different flavors. There's academic self-concept, there's social self-concept, there's behavioral self-concept, the research shows us, and there's physical self-concept as well, how well you think you look, and they have different valences or different levels of importance depending on the stage of life that you're in. Our job when we have a kid who may be weak in one area and strong in the other is to help them believe in themselves in spite of that, to increase the importance to them of the self-concept realm that they're really good in, and not have so much psychological space taken up by the areas that they're not as good in, and to help them if they want help. Now, let's say that child who's really a bit of a klutz wants help in learning to be a better pitcher, then, Cassandra, hey, go for it. If that child, and let him find his way there. And let him go for it. And you know what? If he has a good capacity for facing those frustrations, and there's a coach that'll allow him to do it, then go for it, as long as it's overall something that he's looking for and something that he's growing from and something that the league allows him to do. There's a tremendous building of confidence and tremendous growth that comes from engaging in an area that you're not so good in. And then you look at some of the histories of some of the more famous people. You look at the history of academic failure of Albert Einstein in this state, right? Or Thomas Edison, both from New Jersey, I guess. Or you look at the history of failures of Lincoln. They grew through that. I was just seeing in that article, Rabbi Soloveitchik says about his father, and talking about Rabbi Akiva, that Rabbi Akiva's name comes to the word, like Yaakov, from the word heel. And he says, heel, which is the low, the bottom part of our body, is also the first part of our body that we put forward as we walk. And there's a tremendous lesson in that as well. So we grow. If you have a kid who is energized by failure and isn't taking it too personally and wants to try, then fine. But if not, then maybe you need to just channel it and let him know that there are other ways of excelling, and he doesn't have to mimic his brother in those ways. Does that make sense, sort of? Right, let them find their way, do your best to support it, but also then see if you could find another area, if he's open to it, exactly, yeah. It's not your job to save him from failure and frustration if it's his choice to go that way, and like the neurosurgeon study shows, in fact, that could be an engine of growth that's terrific, okay? Because it could be an actual positive engine of growth, so why not? No, there can't. This is a Jewish audience. Yes, let's hear.
A little yeah. Different question. So, what do you have? You have a child who, Baruch Hashem, he instilled in wonderful values, wonderful things, and he says, "Mom, you taught me all about loving Israel, doing all the right things, and Zionism, and I'm going to the army because I believe in Israel." And I, as mom, say, "But really, all those other things that I taught you, because I really taught you to plant trees in Israel, to give to Jacob." And here's the, so that's a perfect example of we energized him, and now we're at the other stage of the game.
Right. So check your mezuzahs, right? Is that the, so the question is, and that, by the way, it's a common question. So what happens when we did a good job and now they're off to learning? What happens when they turn into something we're not? Or when they take our Zionism seriously? Or take our idealism about the religion seriously? Yeah. Right, right. And so that's the question. By the way, that's a very individual answer. Having a number, you know, of relatives who have taken that path, or some relatives have taken the path, it's been an incredible growth-inducing experience for them to go into the Israeli army. Okay? It's been unbelievable. You know, so, but very, very scary. Okay? Very, very scary, but something you could also be incredibly proud of. I can't answer that for you.
The question isn't so much answering that for me. It's that what do we do to a child? How much do we, you know, after all we've taught them, how much are we destroying all those values of them who are so against them going?
Oh, I see. So what? I see. Yeah, yeah.
If you
want
to answer,
yeah.
Help me get a therapist. That's good.
Yes. Oh, so the question is, it's actually a deeper question. The question is, how do we deal? You're saying. The question is, how do we? I hear. Yeah. And that, so you're saying no after we taught them those values, and how do we manage that dissonance? Right, right. Sure. I hear. Any thoughts? I think it's almost like more in the nature of a comment. I don't have any, in other words, like, cause I think it's a very wise comment, a very honest comment. You know, what happens when, and that happens, it's part of the bittersweet pleasure and pain of raising children, is that sometimes their idealism takes them to a level that we then get frightened about. And I think our key then is how to find that balance. I think just raising and framing the question is very helpful. I won't cheapen the complexity of the issue by even trying to answer it. Also, I don't have an answer. Do you have any thoughts? Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much. I was so good.